Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How entrenched is the animosity between the U.S. and Iran, and what would it take for the two countries to reestablish diplomatic relations? Direct engagement between the two countries was suspended in 1979, and the U.S. has imposed sanctions on the country for 30 of the past 33 years, accusing Iran recently of ongoing nuclear weapons aspirations and condemning its support of Bashar al-Assad in Syria, where pro-democracy uprisings have devolved into all-out civil war. So is there any possible path toward more productive U.S.-Iranian relations, and what would it mean for the broader Middle East? Roxanne Farman-Farmayan joins us to talk about this. She is Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute and Affiliate Lecturer for the International Relations of the Modern Middle East at the University of Cambridge. She spoke yesterday to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Roxanne, welcome to Think.
Thank you for taking me.
So I want to talk a little bit about the background of this deeply strained relationship between these two countries. How did the Iranian Revolution shake the United States' understanding even of its own power?
It was very significant. It was a threshold point in American foreign policy because up until that point, the United States had been simply loved. Its soft power was so resonant with the audiences of the world that that's the hope that they moved towards, a democracy led by the United States in its way of handling civil rights and the rule of law. And when the revolution took place in Iran, for the first time, the United States heard a leader, Ayatollah Khomeini, accuse it of crimes against humanity, of crimes in supporting Shah that had broken human rights laws and had horrible prisons. And it shook the self-image of the United States. And in a sense, after that, it was much more difficult for other states, particularly inside the Middle East, to look at the American universalist model without some ambivalence.
And even when the Shah visited the U.S. for medical treatment, the Iranians were convinced that we were sort of plotting to reinstate him or someone in that regime.
Absolutely. The way that was handled and the timing of it was extremely difficult for the Iranians. Of course, it was difficult for the United States also. This is the element of this story, is that both sides are often at fault for different reasons and read the text differently. But in this particular case, the memory of the Iranians went back to a previous prime minister in the 50s, Prime Minister Mossadegh, who had nationalized oil and then been overthrown by a coup engineered by the United States and Britain together, and which had reinstated the Shah. That coup was hatched in the basement of the embassy, American embassy in Tehran. When the Shah was accepted back into the United States, the U.S. did not inform Iran that it was accepting the Shah into the States for medical treatment, despite the fact that the Iranians had requested that. Likewise, Iran had not been recognized as having a leader, Khomeini, by the United States. They felt as though the U.S. did not corroborate the revolution. And so this combined to inspire a great deal of suspicion as to why had the Shah gone back to the States. The Shah had continued to have a great deal of media coverage by American media. He was a tragic figure without a home and sick. And so it was good theater. And that works really well in the media. And that had made the Iranians feel as though their own revolution had not really been accepted by the United States. It was the only power, that major power, that didn't recognize Khomeini. The British had, the Russians had, others had. So when the Shah went back to the States, it was understood as really a possibility that a new coup could be hatched in the American embassy basement and the entire revolution could be derailed. And that was one of the things that led to the hostage crisis. And, of course, the hostage crisis itself was the great divider between Iran and the United States.
And that was the end of diplomatic relations ever since.
It was the end of diplomatic relations ever since.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the Iran-Iraq war and how that impacted Iran's sense of isolation from the West.
On several counts. First of all, it felt very abandoned by international institutions. The UN did not recognize or condemn the fact that Iraq had attacked Iran. And this is one of the fundamental aspects of the UN, is it's supposed to condemn acts of violence between one state and another that are unprovoked. And so that introduced a sense to the Iranian leadership that they were in a real way on their own, not supported by the international community. Then on top of that, Iraq attacked Iranians with chemical weapons and again failed to condemn Saddam Hussein for doing so. It took many years before the UN actually did promote a resolution to do that. And again, this made Iran feel extremely isolated. The key relationship between Iran and Syria was forged during that time, by the way. Syria and Iran do not really have that much in common on the Shia platform. Indeed, the Alawites are Shia, but it's such an offshoot. It's so heretical that, in fact, they had to have a special law passed to recognize themselves as Muslim when Bashar al-Assad's father, Hafez, became the director of the Air Force and the leader of Syria in order to be recognized by the Constitution. That's not a great reason for Iran to recognize Syria as a compadre. It was because Syria at the time was very against Iraq, but they share a common ideological bent. They're very anti-American, very anti-Israel, and feel very much as though they represent an alternative way of securing the Middle East. So in a sense, that relationship likewise was an isolating move for Iran. It had an ally, but of course it was an ally that too was very much looked down upon by the international community.
So obviously the U.S. and Iran come down on different sides with regard to who they are supporting in Syria. But what would be the impact of bringing Iran into discussions looking for a solution to the civil war there?
I think it would be excellent. It is impossible, in fact, to have a concrete discussion and a negotiating process that actually delivers goods that can be achieved without having every major actor in this conflict involved. It is a move that Egypt and Turkey have decided to make. They have come together and invited both Saudi Arabia and Iran to discuss the situation in Syria. And I think their view is very simply that regardless of ideological divisions, what we have to keep our eye on is to save Syrian lives.
We heard just this morning that the U.S. has put troops in Jordan because the violence is spreading. I mean, how serious is the thought of a far broader region-wide conflict? We know that Turkey's involved in shelling now. How close are we to what would amount to a sort of regional world war?
It really depends on how restrained, in fact, the international community can be. Mm-hmm. The shelling across the Turkey-Syrian border is due to the fact that a great deal of the fighting inside Syria at the moment is in Aleppo, and Aleppo is very close to that border. So generally, it's thought that many of those are stray shells. Mm-hmm. And the retaliation is an opportunity for Turkey simply to draw on its relationship with its NATO allies and make sure that rhetorically, at least, they're protecting it. The move by the U.S. is disconcerting because it's the first time we're seeing international backed forces beginning to move closer. And my view is, indeed, that situation in Syria is not good. Neither was the situation inside Iraq at that time. It's similar in that it's a sectarian kind of conflict in a country. Syria is very similar to Iraq this way, that has no history of civil society, union employment uprisings, any kind of governance or organization internally in terms of a social structure. Very different than Egypt, very different than Tunisia. When there is an overthrow at the top or certainly a confrontation of sovereignty, the chances of a civil war are very high. And that's what we're seeing. So as long as it can stay more or less contained inside Syria, it will not spread, and it will remain a Syrian problem. The concern, of course, is that we feel that as a superpower, we need to be in the midst of everything, mm-hmm. and that we do not accurately play a strong enough role to just simply ensure that others stay out as well and leave the Syrians to fight this out on their own. The problem, of course, complicating this is the fact that Syria is becoming another hub for sectarian conflict, that Salafi fighters are beginning to move across in from Libya, up from Saudi. They're going, a lot of them, through Jordan and Iraq. And so that certainly is making it a more regional war. But again, my view is, and I think so far this is why Russia and China have attempted to, through their vetoing of the various revolutions, to simply keep this a non-internationally involved war, is that if it can remain local, the chances of it not spreading, not involving everybody, is greater.
So Leon Panetta has stressed once again that the U.S. does not want direct military involvement. And I guess putting troops in Jordan is really about prudence and about mm-hmm. keeping the violence contained. Is there any reason whatsoever to doubt the veracity of those remarks?
No, I think that's probably very true. I think the concern overall, and this also gets back to the issue of an Israeli strike on Iran, is any complication, any further enhancement or escalation of conflict in this region at this point could so easily start snowballing into something much larger, more difficult to contain.
Let's talk about what we know for certain about Iran's nuclear program. And I suppose we could spend the rest of the hour saying what we do or do not know for certain. But what has the IAEA found with regard to Iranian nuclear development?
I think one of the things that's really important to realize is that the IAEA is still regularly inspecting Iran. It does send in surprise inspections. And it clearly at this point has had a number of questions that have been posed to it about what it's found. But so far, it has not gone so far as to say that it feels there is a weapon capability being developed in Iran. There's certainly a growing capability in terms of enrichment and the size of its program, but the link towards weaponization has been something that the IAEA has recently certainly tried to shy away from. And this is one of the problems with the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which Iran is a signatory to, which is one of the reasons why the IAEA can still send in inspections. One of the great problems is that in order to develop and have the right to develop nuclear power, it's dual use. And so it's very possible that there would be a capability, anybody developing a nuclear weapon from that power capability.
My guest is Roxanne Farman-Farmayan. She is Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute and Affiliate Lecturer for the International Relations of the Modern Middle East at Cambridge. She was in town to speak to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth yesterday. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment and invite you to join it now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres, October 16th with Chef John Hanney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Roxanne Farman-Farmayan. She is Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute and Affiliate Lecturer for the International Relations of the Modern Middle East at the University of Cambridge. She spoke yesterday to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can be part of the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Roxanne, just to be clear here, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty does make allowances for particular countries to use nuclear capability for medical use, for energy generation. That's not a problem.
No, and that makes it a general. It's not just particular countries. Any country has that right who is a signatory to the treaty, of course, and there are many countries that are not. Israel, for example, is not.
So let's talk about why Iran would want a nuclear weapon and the greatest threat in terms of Iran's perception of existential threat that would cause it to develop a nuclear weapon potentially.
Well, and potentially is a very good word to have ended that sentence with, because it states it does not want to have a nuclear weapon. And has made a number, the supreme leader has made a number of fatwas about that. So it's quite public about this. It's in a dangerous neighborhood. And so one might feel, certainly from the outside, that it has lots of reason to want a nuclear weapon. It's also seen those that don't have nuclear weapons attacked from the outside, such as Iraq, while a country such as North Korea has not been. So it does imply to a country that doesn't have one that perhaps it is a safety shield. The further reason why Iran might have wanted to develop a weapon, certainly in the past, was because a number of its very close neighbors, specifically Iraq, was developing one. And in fact, that is perhaps one of the strongest pieces of information that we have coming from the National Security Intelligence Directive, that when it was interested in a weapon, it was a weapon that was directed at Iraq.
And not Israel.
Not at all Israel. And that when the United States attacked Iraq and in a coalition in 2003, Iran dismantled its entire nuclear weapons planning. It hadn't gone into creating it yet, but it had started planning. That entire branch was dismantled. And that's why our own assessment has been that there's been nothing that has developed since 2002, 2003, and why the Iranians have claimed that they have nothing. What is also very interesting is that, sadly, that led to one of the great missed opportunities, of which there have been several, to try to bring a bridge between Washington and Tehran. And that is that in 2003, as the United States was going into Iraq, the president of Iran, at that time a moderate called Khatami, did send a message to Washington saying, let's talk about everything, the nuclear capability, human rights, terrorism, you name it, let's put it all on the table and let's talk. And very much we think that that was triggered by the fact that Iran had decided, since the U.S. had taken care of Iraq, it was going to dismantle everything. Let's start talking. We have something to talk about.
It seems like a brilliant opportunity for the U.S.
The United States interpreted it as Iran being fearful that the U.S. was moving into Iraq, it might move into Iran next, coming in from a position of weakness. And it was a message that was not responded to by Washington at all. It was ignored. So unfortunately, that was one of those several opportunities that was lost. I'm not saying that Iran is the only one that has offered. There have been times that the United States has certainly extended a hand, and that hasn't been grasped on the other side.
Just briefly, because we have lots of people who want to call in at this point, can you talk about why the United States remains suspicious? Actually, first explain how those messages are transmitted back and forth when there are no official diplomatic relations. How does Iran contact the Department of State and say, we want to sit down and talk?
Well, actually, there are ways of communicating. Both are represented by other countries' embassies, sometimes in different embassies representing the outgoing consular and the ingoing diplomatic. But there are definitely ways that this kind of messaging is usually transported from a commonly recognized embassy, often places like Switzerland, to the capital in question.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Saeed in Dallas. Hi, Saeed.
Hello. Hi. Good morning. How are you?
Very well. Thank you.
I have a question and one comment also. Like when we say uprising democracy, same thing happened in Bahrain also, which is a part of Middle East. The Shia was getting uprising and then they got crushed by security forces of Bahrain as well as Saudi Arabian forces over there. Are we giving the messages to the world that, okay, if you are our friend, we can close our eyes? One. And second, when IAEA requested by Iran that, okay, you go and check other people who have their nuclear ammunition in their arsenal, or they are trying to develop it, go and take care of them also. We will be ready, then you can take care of us also. So is it not that we are just playing double standard? I will take your answer off the line.
Thank you for your call. And the line was not easy to understand, but were you able to get the gist of those questions by Saeed?
I think generally Saeed is perhaps referring to the fact that there is a certain number of double standards that are being exercised on the international theater. And indeed, what happened in Libya contrasted with what happened in Bahrain is a good example of that. And that indeed is where international or U.S. interests might clash with U.S. ideals. And in the situation of Bahrain, we have significant investment in that country for our Navy that is based there to patrol the Persian Gulf. That is a state that we certainly would not have responded to similarly than we might to a place that we don't have significant Navy installations. What's more, in many ways, Bahrain is still very much within the Saudi camp. And it was Saudi Arabia that moved in and settled the situation. And in fact, of course, it does mean that it was not, its uprising was not supported. It caused a great deal of media concern, and it is an area that remains very volatile. And perhaps as time shifts, there will be an ability of the United States to attend to that kind of problem that Bahrain represents to American foreign policy. A situation such as Libya was headed by Gaddafi. I mean, that one was an easy one. We had already tried to distance ourselves from Gaddafi. It was clear he was doing horrible things inside that country. He fell into a similar category of Saddam that in some ways, no matter what the outcome was, it was bound to be better than the situation under, his tutelage. So that was a one that the United States worked with NATO. And in fact, it was a program that was driven by NATO, by France and England, and in many ways the United States took a back seat to their leadership on that. So different places, different problems, different interests, different ideals.
Can you talk a little bit about the state of the Green Movement in Iran? It seems to have gone largely underground, those who were not killed or jailed or exiled. And there's also been cases where members of that movement have sort of been co-opted into other causes and are working with other groups now.
The Green Movement, in many ways, I think it was in 2009, and in many ways was the precursor to the Arab Spring.
Sure.
In some ways, it was the first. The response by the government was so repressive that it was literally smashed and its leaders put under house arrest, and huge numbers of people that had been in the streets were imprisoned in horrible conditions. But likewise, there was a problem with what had happened, which was linked to the election. The vote for Ahmadinejad was at stake in that particular case. And prior to all of the votes being counted, the government precipitously jumped in and announced that Ahmadinejad had won. And this was what shifted the Green Movement from simply being supporters of certain reforms and certain leaders to then really questioning the entire system, demonstrating, saying we want our vote, and questioning Ahmadinejad's election and whether it was fraudulent. The difficulty this presented is that, in fact, it's very likely that Ahmadinejad did win that. And so it was one of those classic cases where the government felt as though it was in the right, even though it had acted badly. And the Green Movement was feeling it might be in the right and had acted well. So and then had been really, destroyed by it. What has happened since, of course, is that Ahmadinejad has proven himself to be persona non grata even inside the Iranian regime. They can't wait to get rid of him by the election in 2013. And the Green Movement really has had to go elsewhere. I mean, there is just no indication at this point that it has significant leadership at all, that there is even a reform movement active in Iran. The cost was too high.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is Roxanne Farman Farmayan. And we next have Scott on the phone in Plano. Hi, Scott.
Hi, I'm enjoying the conversation, but at the top, your guest said that one reason that for the difficulties between Iran and the United States and Americans from the American side was that we had been used to thinking of countries supporting our support for democracy and human rights and so on, and that we were shocked when this was rejected. But it seems to me if that's the basis for on our side of animosity toward Iran, at least at the beginning, that was really seems unfounded since we had already been criticized from everybody from Vietnam to Egypt and others in the Middle East for support for colonialism and Israel and so on. So I hope I'm not oversimplifying your statement, but it seems as an unlikely basis for American reaction to the Iranian Revolution.
Well, let's get a response for you. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you, Scott. I think that you're making a really interesting point here. And it's not as though the United States had not gone through many years of experience, but the ideals that it represented, the universalist aspect that everybody could become democratic, were still untarnished. There was still the sense, even though certainly Vietnam had taken place, there was at that time a feeling the movement's orientation at that point was we have not lived up to our own ideals. That was a movement that took place inside the United States more than outside looking in and saying the U.S. has, broken its promises. The response of Iran was unique in that it pointed out double standards. It used language against the United States ideals, saying we don't even want democracy if that's what it's going to look like. Democracy is a whole concept that has been compromised by the way the United States has acted. And we want neither East nor West. And that was the first time that kind of discourse had truly come out. And there were many elements of that. There was, certainly the sense that the United States had plundered Iran, taken its oil, supported its own programs. That, again, was something that did not jibe with the way the U.S. saw itself. And, of course, this all culminated not just in the rhetoric that was being used as the revolution began and was led by people that were completely foreign to what the United States imagined were revolutionaries, which up until then had been more or less leftists, had been younger people, had been a very different kind of movement. And here there was the religious right, which, of course, we've since come to realize is one of the great movements that also create reforms and revolutions, but at the time was new. And so there was no experience. There was a great sense of betrayal that so much of what the United States had done to invest in Iran, invest in its modernization, had simply been thrown out, and that they did not understand what was happening inside Iran. And then the hostage crisis takes place. And so for, you know, over a year, there is the sense that the United States not only has been betrayed, but that its people are being held by a government on, you know, false premises. And so there was layer upon layer there. So indeed, there certainly was – this was not a totally innocent country. You make a very good point about that. But there, this was a threshold. This was a point where the entire democratic discourse represented by the United States and practiced by the United States began to have cracks not only from the outside but in how the United States was hearing itself described. And that was new.
What are the stated goals of the U.S. sanctions on Iran and the oil trade, and have they been successful in achieving what it is that we want?
The goals have been varied over the three decades plus three years that they have been levied against Iran. Overall, the from the Iranian perspective, certainly there is the view that the general purpose behind them is regime change. Mm-hmm. And there certainly could possibly be an argument made for that in Washington, too, in the sense that nuclear capability held in the hands of those who are friends is a very difficult, a different situation than those that are held in the hands of a regime such as Iran's. Mm-hmm. So there is certainly that or that is present. And so, of course, if that is the case, no, the sanctions have not been successful because the regime remains.
My guest is Roxanne Farman-Farmayan. She is Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute and Affiliate Lecturer for the International Relations of the Modern Middle East at the University of Cambridge. She spoke yesterday to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can be part of the conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres, October 16th with Chef John Hanney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Roxanne Farman-Farmayan. She's Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute and Affiliate Lecturer for the International Relations of the Modern Middle East at the University of Cambridge. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Mohammed in Dallas. Hi, Mohammed. Mohammed, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. I'm
okay,
with you.
Great.
Thank you for having me on the show, by
sure.
the way. My question was for Roxanne, and I wanted to ask her about what's happening right now in Syria and the Iranian government siding with Syria and Bashar al-Assad. But I was wondering, what will the future of the Iranian government and its relationship with Syria be after Bashar al-Assad is ousted?
Thanks for your call.
That is a really good question. The Iranians are certainly aware that Bashar al-Assad may not last very long. So they are certainly making plans for a Syria afterwards. The Iranians are supporting Syria on a number of different levels that are infrastructure-based, energy-based, food-based. They're developing a grid for electricity that goes all the way from Iraq up to Syria. They're doing all sorts of oil and gas arrangements, they know that if the leadership falls, there will be a successor. Syria will still need energy. It will still need all sorts of other help in getting its act together and supporting its people. And Iran wants to be the first port of call. And so it has not only developed all sorts of several programs that go through a number of years, as though there is no civil war, as though they can simply plan for 4 or 5 years of business development. But likewise, they have very close relationships with every level of society, not just the Shia Alawite, in order to make sure that no matter what happens in Damascus, they will be among the most important in-house players, if you will.
How would you characterize the level of support given by the Russians to the Assad regime? And is it does it go as far as weapons and other supplies, or is it simply a sort of sense of collegiality at this point?
It's very difficult to tell, but it's not the level of weaponry that we have generally been led to believe they're giving. I think at the moment, the whole focus, whether it's also, not just the Russians, but also on the opposite side, the Saudis and the Qataris, mm-hmm. everything is small arms. Nobody wants to move in the big, heavy weaponry.
Tanks and missiles.
Yes, tanks and missiles that the opposition certainly is asking for. And I think the Russians are trying to keep the amount of material in Bashar al-Assad's hands, more or less, you know, what he's got is what he has, and not escalate that. So their investment is very much more as a collegial one, but it's based on two very important things that we've got to remember. One is the old Soviet relationship with Syria was very tight, and there are no awful lot of Russians that live inside Syria. So Russia actually has a population problem when it comes to Syria. And the second is that Russia is very, very close to Syria, Iraq, all of these places. It's near abroad includes them. And it does not want to get into an international confrontation. So it is supporting Syria. But it's also exercising its vetoes in the Security Council resolutions, possibly simply to avoid any large confrontation that we would describe as a second global Cold War.
Mm-hmm. Setting aside Syria for a moment, can you talk about common interests that the U.S. and Iran might have with regard to Afghanistan?
They have a lot of common interests. And in fact, this is one of the areas where you realize the lack of trust is so significant that many of the what's called trust building measures that are common on the outskirts of diplomacy in order to bring two sides together mm-hmm. are simply not taking place. And Afghanistan is a perfect example. Drugs in Afghanistan are the issue. Neither of them want the degree of heroin that's being shipped out.
Huge problem in Iran, heroin.
And it's a huge problem in Iran because it's coming over the borders from Afghanistan. The Iranians have built an enormous wall and have lost millions in blood and treasure protecting that wall. And nonetheless, heroin has poured over, infecting not only the Iranian society, but if it doesn't hold that wall, there is literally going to be a heroin tsunami into Europe. And so it feels as though it is key to ensuring that this does not become a huge problem. This, of course, is in the U.S. interest. Likewise, it's been in the U.S. interest to show that it's reduced the amount of poppy growing, that heroin is on a downward trend. And the obvious two parties to this discussion are the United States and Iran, with quite a bit of input by Europeans who will be, you know, receiving an awful lot of the heroin if Iran is left on its own. And yet Iran feels very isolated by that. So there is a great deal to be discussed on a positive level. Now, the negative side of not being able to talk between the two may show up if there is an attack on Iran by Israel, because if that occurs prior to the pullout by U.S. troops from Afghanistan, although the Taliban and the Iranians are not friends, certainly the Iranians can encourage the Taliban to attack Americans. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't need a whole lot of encouragement. And that withdrawal will be very bloody. So there's a vulnerability there to U.S. boots on the ground. Likewise, under the other scenario that we've talked about in terms of Israel's views of Iran.
Obviously, I shouldn't say obviously, but the U.S. would try to dissuade Israel from making a direct strike on Iran.
One would imagine, but whether that is something that can be achieved, we are not sure. Whether it will be something that Israel feels it needs to do for various other reasons. The question of Palestinian recognition in the UN is coming up. There's been no discussion about that on the general airwaves. One of the reasons is that the nuclear issue in Iran is something that Israel has certainly used to dominate the situation and take the onus off its own backyard. So it is very difficult to know. And it is certainly possible that if such an attack takes place, that the United States could be drawn in.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next on the phone with Larry in Dallas. Hi, Larry.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Very nice program, and I have a question and also a comment to Roxanne. My question is going back to a long time ago about foreign policy of the United States in many countries. Especially a long time ago, I was listening to a program that George Shultz of Secretary of State was talking about, and they were asking a reporter from Africa, asked him about Rwanda, that at the time he was saying that over 2 million people being killed in Rwanda and United States didn't do anything as a human rights case. And now we're seeing the situation in Libya, Egypt, as the previous caller was talking about Bahrain and all these things that we hear in the world. My question is this, that whatever is happening all over, when United States is getting involved in it, is really for the human rights or is for the interest of United States. As I was listening long time ago to George Shultz, he was discussing that if it doesn't have any interest for us, we cannot get involved in any problem in the world.
Well, let's get a response for you. Thanks for your call.
In a way, we've already revisited this concept, and it really does go back to the fact that states are very what's called realist in my academic framework, and that is they are driven by interests. They are driven by the well-being and the safety and the needs of their own state first, of their own populations, their own position on the world stage. And so one has a benign country like the United States, certainly aware of and interested in human rights, wanting to pursue that as one of its great goals. But these are complex issues. The United States does not go into a place or withdraw from a place just for one reason. And so it's a complex, multi-layered type of foreign policy dilemma. And in some cases, one aspect of the interests will predominate, and in another, we shall see. You know, we'll see a different kind of policy, which is why, from the outside, it can seem like double standards. But from the inside, it often seems very much as though it's driven by a similar set of standards.
Is that pragmatism pretty much universal? I mean, are we unlike other countries in that we think of our pragmatic needs first, and then what we can do with regard to human rights second?
It is quite universal. I think the nature of the government, the nature of the system, whether it's a democratic system, really does make a difference rather than other countries that, say, might be driven by ruthless dictators. But that's one of the great differences between domestic politics and international relations, is that countries may be extremely democratic on the inside, but when it comes to representing their own state on the international stage, every country is driven by their own interests, and pragmatism is always going to be the primary. And although they may have alliances, they may have friends, there certainly isn't the type of democratic process that they exercise necessarily at home.
Do you see any signs whatsoever of in the near future, détente between the U.S. and Iran? Are we moving in that direction, or are we as locked into mutual animosity as we ever have been?
I think we still have some ways to go. Mm-hmm. I think part of it is that we need to determine very much more clearly what our interests are in terms of coming to a negotiating table with Iran. And they do too, because one of the problems of these many lost opportunities is that there hasn't been a consistency between the negotiators and those at home, or between the negotiators and the way the media has interpreted it, or, you know, that kind of thing. So we have seen at different points a certain amount of dialogue taking place, and then a great deal of retrenchment on both sides. Mm-hmm. And we have to avoid that retrenchment. We have to go knowing what we can do, what our population will allow us to do, Congress, whatever. And they have to do the same thing. And once that is clarified, then it will be clear, it will be easier to come up with a level of negotiation that will hold on those points that can be discussed.
Do you feel like U.S. leaders have been irrationally afraid of a sort of existential threat from Iran?
It's interesting, the word irrational, because that's a word that's often used by the United States to describe the Iranians, and the Iranians use it back to the United States. And the problem, I think, very simply, is that because they are often so misunderstood, the whole approach to language, the whole approach to negotiation is so fundamentally different that they're often not able to read between the lines. They are not able to understand how something is being offered. And as a result, I think there is some irrationality on both sides, simply because the fear of the other is enormous. And at this point, their foreign policies are quite vested in having the other as the great enemy. Mm-hmm. And the whole structure of Middle East politics would shift if suddenly the United States and Iran were to start being on the same side or having significant areas of common interest.
Potentially destabilizing?
Personally, I think it could be very stabilizing in some ways, but I think it would compromise the relationship between the United States and Israel, which is something that the United States certainly is not willing to do at this point. So there's always the compromise on one side for the benefit on the other.
Roxanne Farman-Farmayan is Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute and Affiliate Lecturer for the International Relations of the Modern Middle East at the University of Cambridge. She spoke yesterday to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Roxanne, thank you so much for giving us this hour.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is Senior Producer. You can find out about upcoming programs and download the podcast every day at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.